Hi, everybody. My name is Christy Miller, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. After hearing Olive and Heidi talk, I can say I am the carrier of the disease. I'm the one who brought it into our home. I want to thank Olive and Heidi for the wonderful talks that they have given and the wonderful recovery that they shared with us. I really needed it, and it has enriched me. I want to thank the committee for inviting us here. What a thrill it is. I'm back in Columbus, Georgia, running on my treadmill, driving kids to dancing lessons and going to work and doing my things, and the phone rings and it's someone in Arizona that wants me, to come share how sick I've been. It really is rather mind-boggling, and it always sounds like such a wonderful adventure. I say, oh, yes, I'd love to come, and I get here, and it's so beautiful out here. It's just so gorgeous. And then I realize I have to share me, that's the painful part. It's all worth it. But I want to thank you for inviting us. It's been a really special adventure for us to have come out here and gotten to meet y'all. And I want to thank you for the beautiful baskets that were in our rooms. They're just wonderful. We have three daughters, though, and two baskets, and we haven't worked that out yet, but we will. So we are delighted, and I want to thank Janice for picking us up at the airport, and I understand that if Jim and I do a so-so job, she'll take us back to the airport, and so I'm going to try really hard to do that. I want to share a little bit about my family before I get into my disease, because my disease is, as they all are, is very self-centering. So I want to share with you my family. I have, I think, the best and most wonderful family in the whole world. Jim is here with me this morning, and y'all will get to meet him and learn a little bit about him tomorrow. I feel really blessed. Jim and I got married when we were in our early 20s, and we knew everything. I married Jim because he was a very honest man, full of integrity and responsibility, and a wonderful person to be around. And he still has those qualities. But what Al-Anon has done in his life and in our lives is that it's brought the joy out in Jim. It's brought the child out in him. Sometimes I can't put the child to bed at night. But it has brought so much joy to our lives, and it's brought God into our home. But Jim is he's just very special to me. I feel so blessed to be married to him. No matter what we're going through these days, it is such a wonderful thing to be able to rely on the confidence of our commitment to our 12-step programs, because that means that no matter what turmoil is going on in our lives, and if Jim and I are having trouble connecting or communicating or whatnot, I just have the utmost faith that both of us will go back to basics and search out, our own responsibility in the problem, and we'll get back to each other and work it out. And that is a wonderful sense of trust to have, and I'm very grateful for it. Jim and I have three girls, and they are the light of our lives. They are now 15, 11, and 9, and they are truly, truly wonderful. Our 15-year-old is an Alateen, and I'm very proud of that, and it's really, really joyous to see her attend. She's very typical, though. Ray grew up around Al-Anon and AA, and from about the time she could start talking, she started asking when she could go to Alateen. And we told her, you have to wait till you're 13. You have to wait till you're 13. And finally, the day came when she was 13. And I went into her room and I said, Ray, today's the day you get to go to Alateen. She looked at me and said, I'm not going to any Alateen meeting. Hey, typical. Those teenage hormones are wonderful. But she's a joy. She's going to give her first Alateen talk a week from today, as a matter of fact. And Jim and I have not yet been invited to that, and but we'll see. I have to tell you my favorite story about her, because our children, as Heidi so vividly shared with us, our children, I think, so often see the truth of what is going on in our homes and the truth of our disease. But my favorite story about Ray is that the last time I was in treatment, I was gone a long time. I was gone about 3 months, and I'd been home about 6 months. It was the middle of summer, And Jim and I had been talking. We decided that we needed to have a party for some of his business associates. And so we planned this dinner party for them, and as we made our plans, we had a long discussion about whether we should serve any alcohol or not. And we finally decided that it would probably be appropriate to serve a little bit of beer and wine. Well, it was Jim's job to get that and serve that. And the day of the party, he did. He went off to the store, and he came back, and I heard him putting something in the refrigerator. And, you know, I was so cool about it. After about 30 minutes, I couldn't stand it any longer. I had to go look and see what he bought. And I opened the refrigerator, and we're having 14 people to dinner, and he bought half a gallon of white wine and a six-pack of beer. I said, Jim, what is this? This is an afternoon snack. You know, who are you going to feed with this? And he said, Chrissy, he said, you turn this over to me. You need to let it be my job. And I said, well, okay. Well, much to my surprise, we had some left over. This was not a wild party, I can tell you. And the next day, on this hot summer day, my daughter Ray and I were standing at the refrigerator. Ray was about 7 years old at this time, and we were standing at the refrigerator and looking for something to drink. And she saw that beer and wine. She said, Mom, what are you going to do with the leftovers? And I was being cute. I said, well, I could drink them. And she said, that's not a good idea, Mom. And I said, well, why not, Ray? And she said, if you drink it, you won't be home for Christmas. That kind of sums up my alcoholism, y'all. Our second daughter, Katie, is 11. She's a marvelous, enthusiastic, creative child. Our home these days is a recovering home. It's very much an AA and Al-Anon home, and there are people in and out of our house all the time. There are people staying at our house all the time. They're either there on trips, they're coming through, they're getting divorced, they're, you know, whatever they're going through, they always end up in our guest bedroom. And I laughed one day about 5 months ago. I was walking by the guest bedroom, and Katie had put a sign-up sheet on the door so we could keep track of who was coming in and who was going out. And amazingly enough, we filled it up very quickly. She had to put another one up. So, and then there's Jessica, our baby, who's this platinum blonde, gorgeous child who thinks she was made for the movies. And I'm not going to tell her any differently. I think maybe she was. But we have a good time at our house. Those are our natural children. We also have our AA children that all have keys to our house. And as long as they come in and put the coffee on and get things going, they are welcome to come in our home anytime. That's wonderful for me. I didn't grow up in an alcoholic home, but I grew up in the type of home where you called first before you came over so that everything was perfect. And I learned that lesson well. I thought that's the way it was supposed to be. And, you know, please don't show up at my house without letting me know you're coming first so I can have all the dishes washed and the floor spotless. I can tell you unequivocally that I was a better housekeeper drunk than I am sober. You know, I was working really hard to keep the facade up while I was drinking. And now there is no more facade. And what a relief. What a relief it is. So we're really having a good time at our house. I had my first drink when I was about 11 years old. I had that drink because I had a friend spending the night at my house, and her parents were social drinkers. My parents were social drinkers, and we started talking about booze, and we were really interested in it. We wanted to find out what it was all about. So we went behind my dad's bar and got out a bottle of scotch because that's what our parents drank, and we took it into our den, and we unscrewed the cap and started drinking that scotch. And it tasted terrible. But we got it down because we were bound and determined, and we got drunk. We both got very drunk. But something happened that night, and I share this with you because it's important to me as I look back on it, that my friend Betsy got knee-walking, tongue-slurring, throwing-up kind of drunk, and I didn't. I got that kind of all put together, I feel like I can do anything, the world is okay kind of drunk. And I remember standing in front of the mirror and looking at myself and trying to talk, and I wasn't slurring my speech, and thinking, this is okay. And I remember looking at her as she was throwing up in the corner and thinking, that is not okay. You know, at 11 years old, I just intuitively knew that it was not acceptable for women to get tongue slurring, knee-walking, throwing up drunk. And I made a vow right then that I would never drink and be like that. And I worked very, very hard all through my years of drinking to keep that vow, to keep myself together, that that I may drink, but you may not know how much I'm drinking or that I'm drunk. I tried very, very hard to keep that facade up and was pretty successful up until the late stages of my disease. It's for those reasons, that experience, really, that that I believe that I've always had the disease of alcoholism. It was just a matter of time and booze, you know, before it worked its ravages in my life. I went to Duke in North Carolina in 1970 and met Jim there. And we fell in love and we partied a lot and we had a good time. We got married right after I graduated with a degree in nursing, and he was going off to medical school and we were going off to live, you know, just the most wonderful, perfect life together. And we worked very hard, and we had friends that worked hard, and we all partied hard. And that just fit in right with who I was, that if we were going to party really hard on Friday and Saturday nights, well, I could probably make it through the week. So alcohol was not causing a problem in my life at that point. And it wasn't until after Jim and I had married and moved to Dallas, Texas. We'd been married about 3 years when we moved to Dallas, Texas, for Jim to do his internship and residency, that I really crossed that invisible line that we talk about, where you know, you lose the ability to control, and the powerlessness really sets in. And it was in Dallas that happened for me. And it happened right after I gave birth to Ray. And I was working as the head nurse on a cancer floor. And I was very isolated into my work and into my motherhood role. And Jim was doing his work. And I didn't have any support system, but I was working very hard. And I thought that this was no big deal. But I was restless, irritable, and discontent. And I know that's what it was now. I certainly didn't know what it was then. But for whatever reasons, through that feeling of restlessness and irritability, I decided that I needed a little help along the way, and that things would probably be okay if I took some of those Tylenol with codeine off the medicine cart. And so that's what I began doing. And I very quickly progressed from there into the narcotic cabinet and began stealing drugs from there. And within a very short period of time, I was off and running. And I mean within a matter of weeks, that I remember signing out the narcotic book one morning after I'd worked the night shift and looking down the sheet of Demerol and realizing that I had taken over 1,500 milligrams of Demerol that night. And it scared me. It scared me a lot. Now, y'all, what scared me about that was not that I hadn't done my job. I felt like I had done my job. And to the best of my knowledge this day, I had done my job that night. What scared me about that was that my one experience with a nurse being caught taking drugs from a hospital was that they called the sheriff, and he came in and arrested her right there in front of the staff and everyone, put handcuffs on her, and dragged her away. And it was very humiliating and shameful for her, and it was the same for those who had to watch it. And my fear was that was going to happen to me. And so I knew I couldn't do that anymore, that I was going to get caught, and I wasn't willing to risk that shame. But you see, I'd already crossed that line, and I was already addicted, and I was in over my head, and I was powerless. And even though I thought, well, I'll stop doing this, and I thought that, you know, when I meant I'd stop doing it, I'd stop taking drugs, I didn't know I didn't have a choice. And so I had to look for another source. So what I began doing was writing my own prescriptions. And I began writing prescriptions for a drug called Percodan. And I began using my husband's name and narcotic number because that's what was available to me. And off I went. For about 9 months, I wrote a prescription every day for 36 Percodan every day. And every day I took that many. And yeah, that's a bunch. I have an incredibly high tolerance. I had somebody ask, well, the law got involved at one point. They thought I was selling them, and the agent asked me, you know, how I could possibly take 36 a day. I said, it's very easy. You take them 8 at a time. And that is literally what I did. Anyway, after 9 months, I hit a bottom with that. For whatever reasons, the reality of what was happening in my life hit me. To the best of my knowledge at that point, no one at work knew what I was doing. Jim didn't know what I was doing. I was just, you know, fighting like crazy to keep up the facade of who I was supposed to be. But after 9 months, I knew I could no longer do it. I knew the facade was going to crumble, and I was scared, and I didn't really want to go to jail, and I didn't want to die. And I looked around Dallas, Texas, and I realized that I didn't have a friend there except for Jim, and I knew I needed help. So one night, when Jim came in from work, I gathered up my courage, and I told him what I had done and what I had become and how scared I was. And I did that with full knowledge and full belief that what Jim was going to do was leave me. I mean, who would want to be married to a drug-addicted woman? To my surprise, what Jim did was put his arms around me. And he said, "Christy, I don't understand everything that's going on, but I understand that you're sick. And I understand that we can get you help and that everything can be okay." You know, we know now, looking back on that day, that the reason that Jim could do that was because his dad was sober for 5 years in Alcoholics Anonymous when he died. And Jim knew something about addiction. And most of all, he knew something about recovery, and he knew there was hope. So he set off to get me well, and I withdrew from the Percodan and began seeing a psychiatrist, and we were going to live happily ever after again. Well, a funny thing happened on the way to the psychiatrist. I had these drugs no longer. You couldn't smell the drugs, and I was desperate, and I still had this hole blowing through my gut, and I was, you know, if I'd been restless, irritable, and discontent before, you know, now it was in major proportions. And so, of course, I turned to alcohol. It was at that point when I turned to alcohol that I became a morning drinker, a daily drinker, and an all-day drinker. And that's the way I stayed till the day I took my last drink. But I began seeing this psychiatrist, and I began drinking. And one night after I'd been drinking fairly late into the evening, it occurred to me that there might be one other person in this world who could understand what was going on with me, and that was my mother-in-law. It was a lady that Jim's dad had met when he came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and she had quite a bit more sobriety than he did. But they fell in love, and they'd gotten married. And she was living in Pine Mountain, Georgia, and had been sober, I guess, about 14, 15 years at this point. And it occurred to me in my drunken stupor that Lillian might understand what was going on with me. And so I called her that night, and all I could get out to her on the phone was, "Lillian, I need you." Now, all this addiction and my alcoholism had come up since I'd left Georgia, and Lil had not seen any of it. She didn't have a clue as to what was going on in our lives when I sent out that message of help. But, you know, she was on the next plane, and she was in Dallas, Texas by 2 o'clock the next afternoon. And, you know, I know and you know that because she was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, when one hand reached out, you know, her hand was right there for me. And she got to Dallas, and I brought her into our living room, and I shared with her the story of my drug addiction. I failed to mention to her that I was drinking a quart a day. I really didn't think it was pertinent, and I didn't think it was that big a problem. And I certainly didn't want to tell her to tell me that I needed to stop. But I shared the story of my drug addiction and the pain that had caused me. And as I finished, she got this funny little smile on her face. And I said, "Why are you smiling?" And she said, "Because we can go to a meeting." I went, "Oh, no, I've made a major mistake. A major, major mistake." You know, Jim and I had spent a lot of time at her home and Jim's dad's home in Pine Mountain. They lived up there in Pine Mountain. They lived in a big Victorian home with the wide front porch, with the rocking chairs lined up around the front porch. They always had a bunch of drunks in and out of that house. They used to love to go down and empty out the prison and bring them all home. I made the mistake of asking one time, you know, "What's so-and-so in for?" And then I never asked again after that. So this place terrified me. You know, they always had a huge coffee pot in the kitchen going. There were always people on that porch in all those rocking chairs sitting there drinking coffee, smoking cigarettes, rocking back and forth, talking about God and serenity and humility. And, you know, I was 20 years old when I was going to visit, and I thought, you know, this is not the life for me. I want a boogie. You know, I don't want to end up in a rocking chair talking about God. Now, that's what I thought was going to happen to me. But, and I knew that was going to happen the minute I stepped into AA. But, you know, I'd called her all this way from Georgia to Dallas, and I wasn't going to be rude, so I said, okay, let's go to a meeting. Well, off we went to a meeting, and it was a women's meeting. And I remember nothing about that meeting except that that I shared the fact of my drug addiction with them. And you know, and I made it perfectly clear that I was a highly successful social drinker. And those wonderful women, you know, told me to keep coming back. And they also tried to share with me that they knew that, you know, that if one drug was taken away, that I would turn to another, and that it would be alcohol. And, you know, and I tried to explain to them that that wasn't true in my case. And off we went. Well, Lil stayed for a while, and when she left, she suggested that I continue going to AA. And I did. I continue going to AA as off and on, or actually fairly regularly, but I also continue to drink. I didn't know how not to drink. And I went to AA, I think, to keep the world from crashing down around my shoulders. I kept going, too, I think, because I hoped that one night I'd walk in there and, you know, the magic wand would get waved over my head and I'd get sober. And I was willing to do about most anything except quit drinking and work the steps. So I kept getting sicker. And in 1981, Jim and I moved to Columbus, Georgia, and I'm still going to AA. I'd started going in, what, 79, is that correct? That first meeting was in 79, and I'd continued going and drinking. And in 81, Jim and I moved to Columbus, and by this time I knew it was the geographical cure, but in my case it was going to work. I was going to prove you wrong. And it did work. I stayed sober for the 2 days it took us to drive from Dallas to Columbus and thought I'd beaten the rap. But things continued to get worse when we got to Columbus, and I was beginning to lose my ability to keep up the facade that I was okay. You know, the meals were getting fewer and fewer between. You know, it was harder and harder for me to do the simple things like laundry and grocery shopping and, you know, making a date with someone to go to lunch and keeping it. You know, I slowly but surely was losing the ability to keep up that facade. I'd been in and out of treatment a couple of times by this point, and Jim's and my relationship was just one of real isolation. We existed together. There was not a lot of anger in our house. It was really pretty quiet. When I drank, I pretty much just wanted to be left alone. But I was dying. I was dying. And at Christmas in 1981, Jim was at the hospital, and I had just put Ray to bed, and I was beginning to get the things out from Santa Claus when I realized for the first time that I didn't have anything for Jim for Christmas, not one gift. And y'all, I mean, you know, then I panicked. Today I look back on that, and, you know, nothing speaks of the selfishness of alcoholism stronger to me than that night, that I was so consumed with myself, where my next drink was coming from, whether I could keep up the facade or what, that I hadn't even gotten the man I loved a gift for Christmas. But it devastated me that night. And so, like any good alcoholic, I put on my thinking cap, you know, how do I get out of this one? And I finally came up with it, that I knew that what Jim wanted more than anything in this world for Christmas was for me to get sober. And so I sat down at the desk and I wrote him a note, and the note said, I will go to any length. And I put it in his stocking, and I poured myself another drink, and I went to bed. About 10 days later, I hit another bottom. I had completely lost the ability to keep up my facade. I was now drinking and going to bed and drinking and falling downstairs, and things were very bad. And I'd begun to drink with an abandon that I felt was going to kill me very quickly. And so I called Lillian one more time. And at this time, Lillian was the secretary of our Georgia State Assembly, and she was down in Macon, which is where our state office is, and she was putting out our AA newsletter, which we call The Messenger. And she was down there putting that out, and she said, Christy, come down here to Macon and spend a few days with me. And so I did. I went down there for about 4 days, and I shook a lot, and I listened a lot. I tried for once to keep my mouth shut and just listen to what she had to say. And Lillian always had a lot to say. So I had a lot to listen to. Lil was about 5 feet tall and just a bundle of energy. And she was one of those people that you meet in the program who is just AA from the top of their head to the tip of their toes. They walk it, they talk it, they live it, they breathe it. You know, you see it in their eyes and you can feel it coming from their soul. And that was Lillian. And so I stayed with her, and she talked to me. And I tried to listen. And after 4 days, she said, "Christy, you need to go home. You know what you need to do. You need to go home and get a sponsor. You need to work the steps. You need to get involved. You need to just not drink one day at a time." She said, "Go home. I'll be here for you, but go home." So I went home, scared to death. And I just didn't drink one day at a time. And I started going to meetings and listening. And I started reading my big book. And I started working my steps. And I asked Lillian to be my sponsor because in Columbus there in the early 80s, there weren't a whole lot of women running around. And I trusted Lillian more than anyone in the world. And I knew she knew how to get sober. So I asked her to be my sponsor, and she walked with me. And I got sober. Lillian also, as she took both me and Jim by the hand, took us all over the state of Georgia and introduced us to all her friends that she had known over the years, and she put us to work at everything that she was involved in. And, you know, what a gift to have someone like that who brings you into the program and makes you feel a part of immediately. You know, that she said, you know, "You already have something to give. Sit behind that table and write down names. That's all you have to give, but sit there and do it." And, you know, and I felt a part of. No matter what I'd been doing the last 2 years, I felt a part of. And I began to get sober. And what a joy it was. I became pregnant with our second daughter, and then a couple of years after that, I became pregnant with our third daughter. And it was while I was pregnant with Jessica, our third daughter, that something began to change inside of me. It was one of those times, and I've talked with so many people since then, that who've been about 3 years sober, who go through some kind of emotional upheaval, that something wasn't right inside my gut. As I prayed in the morning, as I did my meditation, as I sat in meetings, I just didn't feel connected anymore. I felt like I'd lost that. I felt very blocked. I'd missed somewhere along the way that faith was not a feeling, that faith was an action, that you keep doing even when you don't feel it. But when I didn't feel it at this point in my life, I stopped doing, is what I did. When I felt like my prayers were blocked, I thought, "Oh, I'm pregnant, I'm tired, it's no big deal, I've been really busy. I'll just get back to this after the baby's born." The same with my reading, the same with my talking to people, the same with my going to meetings. And I kept going to meetings, but I wasn't there. You know, we've all sat in meetings where you've been there in body and not in spirit. And, you know, that's great when you're a newcomer, but if you're doing that after you've been here for a while and not acknowledging it, something's wrong. And I didn't acknowledge it. I was scared to acknowledge it. I looked around, and Lillian was in the hospital at this point. She was very sick. She had cancer and some very severe heart disease. And I looked at Lil, and I said to myself, you know, her problems are so much greater than yours. You know, you're just restless, irritable, and discontent. It's no big deal. You know, don't lay any more on her. She's got enough problems. And I looked around to the other women in the program, and I thought, I don't really need to share what's going on with me with any of them. You know, if I tell them what's going on with me, they'll think I'm not working a good program. Well, Miss AA. And so I stayed quiet. You know, that false pride kept me quiet. And y'all, I had no more idea that I was racing towards a drink than a man in the moon. Because I'd remember distinctly thinking, kind of several months before this began happening, as I was riding down the road one day, I remember distinctly thinking, I love being sober. I love what's going on in my life being sober. And you know I'll never drink again. Why would I ever drink again and give all this up? I have a good life with a good husband. I love my AA. I love my home group. Why would I ever give this up? And I think the day I thought that and felt that and felt like I would never drink again was the day I stopped treating my disease. You know, you don't have to do anything about something that's never going to happen. And I think that's the day I stopped treating it. Well, Jessica was born, and when Jessica was about 5 or 6 weeks old, and this feeling of restlessness and being blocked and disconnected had been with me for about 4 months or so, she had a particularly restless night one night when she was about 5, 6 weeks old. And I decided that she had the colic. Actually, I think her mother had the colic, but I decided she had the colic. And the doctor given me this prescription for Paragaric that I could give her if she developed the colic. And so I went and had that prescription filled. And y'all, I never even made it home from the drugstore. I drank it in the car. Have any of y'all ever drunk straight Paragaric? You got to really want to drink it, you know, to drink straight Paragaric. And I got home, and I didn't think about it for a while because the Paragaric was in control. But after a couple of hours, as it kind of started wearing off, I thought, oh, my God, what have I done? What have I done? And then my alcoholism talked to me, and it says, no big deal, Christy. You know, you've been pregnant, you've been under the stress, you've been busy, da-da-da. Nobody will ever know. Don't worry about it. You know, it was an isolated incident. You deserved a break. Just forget about it. And, you know, and of course that's what I wanted to do. And so I believed the voice and I said, okay, I'll forget about it. Well, the next day I couldn't forget about it because I had a refill on that prescription. And I went back and I refilled it. And again, I didn't make it home. And again, the voice talked to me and said, don't worry about it. Nobody will ever know. The only way they'll ever know is if you tell them. And so I stayed quiet. And that voice also told me, don't worry about it because tomorrow's going to be different. You know, once again, the lies come back. That old story of tomorrow's going to be different. I didn't have any more refills on it, but the next day was different. I was back at the liquor store, you know, and I was off and running again. I drank for about 4 months, fighting again to keep the control, still going to meetings, still pretending like everything was okay. You know, I'd done that for a while when I was first in AA, those first couple of years. But, you know, now y'all were my friends, my family. You were my life. You were the very core of my life. And I was walking into AA meetings, and I couldn't look you in the eye. And I didn't want you to hug me. And, you know, my way of controlling was to fight like crazy on the days that I went to meetings to quit drinking at 2 o'clock in the afternoon so you couldn't smell me. But of course, I felt like you could smell me, so I wanted all of you staying way out there. And, you know, and if there was any way I could get out of going to a meeting, I'd do that too and just keep on drinking. You know, I've heard a few people say in meetings and from the podium that the reason that alcoholics help each other is because one alcoholic can't fool another alcoholic. I don't believe that, y'all. We can fool each other. You know, I fooled my home group for 4 months. To this day, not one of them has been able to come up to me and say, I knew you were drinking during that time, because they didn't know. I shut them out that effectively, you know. And so I fooled them. Big deal, you know. I was the one who was dying. I was the one who the disease was eating up from the inside out. And it didn't matter, you know, whether I was fooling them or not, because I was the one who was going to die. Y'all, I'd been sober 3 years. I started drinking, and I drank for 4.5 months before it occurred to me for the first time it occurred to me I could tell somebody what was going on with me. The disease, you know, came roaring back in my life and crippled me, you know, immediately. Wiped out kind of everything that I'd had before and just exerted all its power in my life. And it was 4.5 months before it occurred to me to call you and tell you what was going on with me. Well, Lillian was very ill at this point, and there was a couple that Jim and I had spent a lot of time with in recovery. We still spend a lot of time with in recovery. We've been eating dinner with them after our Tuesday night meeting for almost 12 years now, and that's a very special ritual to us. And I decided that I could call Joe. And Joe was the alcoholic and lived as Al-Anon, and I decided I could call Joe and tell him what was happening to me. So I took a deep breath and I picked up the phone, and Libba answered the phone. Now, I love Libba. Libba's one of my best friends in the whole wide world, but she's an Al-Anon, y'all, and you know that you can smell alcohol over the phone. And for whatever reasons, you know, I couldn't tell Libba first. I just couldn't. I had to talk to Joe. And I just hung up. I didn't say a word. I just slammed the phone down in her face. Well, after a couple of minutes, I took another deep breath, and I tried again. And darn if she didn't answer the phone again. And so again, I hung up without saying anything. And I guess I probably poured myself another drink and took another deep breath, and I tried one more time because I really wanted to talk to Joe. And little did I know, but while I was doing that, Libba was on the other end of the phone talking to Joe, saying, "Joe, there is some drunk that wants to get in touch with you, and the next time the phone rings, you better answer it." And so the next time I called, Joe answered the phone. And I told him what was going on. And that evening, our best friends came over to our house, and Joe 12-stepped me and Libba 12-stepped Jim. And I wanted so badly to get sober again. I wanted so badly to get out of the living hell that I was in. And I couldn't do it. You know, I realize now as I look back on it, what I really wanted was to be 3 years sober again. That's what I really wanted, and I wanted it immediately. And I was very confused when I went back and picked up a white chip, and I, you know, cried buckets and just and felt awful, and why I couldn't stay sober. I kept on drinking and kept on drinking. And I ended up in the hospital for a while, and it was while I was in the hospital then, it was September of 1984, that I ended up in the hospital, that I became very depressed. And now I was one of these people who before this time didn't really believe in depression. I thought depression was just feeling sorry for yourself. But I became a believer at this point in my life. I mean, it was like I woke up and I took a look around me and I realized that I had destroyed all that was valuable to me. And I was very, very confused. I couldn't understand how, if I loved my sobriety so much, if I loved living sober, how could I give it up? How could I give it up? I must have been a hypocrite. I just must be constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself. That must be me. And that made me feel like a bad person. I couldn't clear, get through that wreckage to understand that the only crime I had committed was that I'd stopped treating my disease on a daily basis. You know, the big book says that we are granted a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition, period. And that's what I'd done, was I had given up taking care of my spiritual condition. That wasn't a crime. It didn't make me a bad person. It made me a sick person. But I felt bad. I felt very bad, and I wouldn't forgive myself for it. And I stayed very angry at me. And I stayed very, very depressed. And after I got out of this hospital, I stayed sober 9 months. I stayed sober 9 months out of fear. I stayed sober because I felt like I was going to die if I drank again. Because the last time I drank, I'd ended up in an alcoholic coma. And it had gotten my attention. And I decided that the alcohol would kill me. And so out of fear, I didn't drink for 9 months. But I was depressed, and I was angry. Y'all, I was so angry at you. You know, I would walk into meetings of AA, and I'd sit there and look around the room and take your inventory. You know, I'd go, look, there's Susan over there. She's been sober since 1492. Wonder if she took as good a four-step as I did. I took a really good one. I'd look at you, I'd be angry because I'd hear people share who said, you know, that they were getting off track. And some old geezer from the back of the room, you know, every AA club's got one. You've got one in Al-Anon rooms, I know you do. You know, but that one who always takes it upon themselves to see the danger signal and pull you off to the side and say, you know, you're getting off track. If you keep doing what you're doing, you're going to get drunk. But let me tell you some things you can do so that doesn't have to happen. And I was furious at you because no one had done that for me. No one had saved me. Well, you know, it's awfully hard to save a person when you don't know they're in trouble. You know, and when I walk into my meetings every single night and smile and tell you I'm fine, that nothing's bothering me, and, you know, I just share all this spiritual richness, and, you know, how are you going to know I'm in trouble? How in the world are you going to know I'm in trouble? But I was mad at you because you couldn't see through my facade, and it's not your job to read my mind. But I stayed angry at you. I was jealous because you were sober and I wasn't. I was angry at Jim. Jim had dug into Al-Anon at this point, and he was doing well. He had the audacity to wake up smiling in the morning, and it just... I was really angry at him because he was okay. I was angry at you because you told me he was doing well. You came up to me all the time and told me, you know, how much I had to be grateful for. And you were right. I mean, you tell me, you know, Christy, you're married to Jim and he still loves you and, you know, he's a wonderful guy. You've got three wonderful kids. You have a beautiful home. You know, why do you say stay so stuck and so angry? And you see, what I knew that you didn't know was that I didn't deserve any of those things. I didn't feel like I deserved any of them. And so I stayed angry because you told me about that, and I stayed angry because Jim was okay. I was angry at God. I was furious at God. I really felt like that's where the blame for this whole mess was. I'd been in AA long enough that I knew I couldn't really specifically blame it on, you know, you, but I felt like I could blame it on God, and I didn't understand why he wanted this in my life. You know, and I think I spent a lot of time saying, oh, why me, God? That's, you know, it reminds me of this story. There's this guy who'd been to a meeting and he'd gone home that night and he hit his knees and he was praying. And while he was praying, he was saying, God, he said, look, I can't take anymore. You know, in the last week, I have lost my wife. My house burned down. My car got stolen. My dog ran away. And I got fired today. Why me, God? And this voice kind of he heard down from the ceiling that said, I don't know, George. There's just something about you that pisses me off. Well, that's, I felt like that was kind of my status with God at that point. But I sure was not laughing about it. But I stayed very angry. As a matter of fact, while I was in the hospital at one point, my minister came to see me, and he walked in, sat down, and I was being fairly belligerent. I said, Bill, if you've come to talk about God, I can't do that today. And he looked me dead in the eye and said, so you're angry at God, huh? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, get in line, honey. I said, oh. Isn't that wonderful? You know, God loves me enough that it's okay that I get angry. It's okay. He still loves me. You know, his love is not conditional on whether I'm angry or happy or spiritual or praying or not praying. God just loves me. But I couldn't see that then. Most of all, my anger was at myself. Because like I told you, I couldn't give up that idea that I had committed a terrible crime. And I knew I had given up that I considered most precious in my life. And so I stayed dry for 9 months. And at the end of 9 months, I got to a point where I didn't care whether it killed me or not. I was so unhappy and I was so stuck that I decided that it would be okay if I died from my disease of alcoholism. And I was going to try and make sure that happened. And so on the 13th of September, 1985, I got up that morning and I went to the liquor store. I bought 2 quarts of vodka. We always end up on vodka, don't we? I bought 2 quarts of vodka. I gathered up all the pills I could find around the house. And I made an appointment for a babysitter to come at 6 o'clock that evening, and then I waited. And about 2 o'clock that afternoon, Joe called me. Now, Joe and I, you know, and Jim and Libba still were having dinner together on Tuesday nights, and I saw him all the time at meetings. But it had been a long time since Joe had called specifically to say the words, how are you doing, Christy? And when he asked me that afternoon, I told him in real explicit terms how I was doing. And he said, well, we're not going to let you go without a fight. And in 10 minutes, he was at our back door. And he came in and sat down, and he said, Christy, he said, we can do whatever it takes. You know, if you need me to stay here all afternoon or this evening, I'll stay. If we need people to spend the night with you, we'll call the group. If you need them all weekend, we can do it. If you need them for a week, we can do it. He said, we're willing to go to any length. You know, what do you need? And we'll do it. And I told him that what I really needed was for him to leave. And thank you very much. Now that morning when I had gotten up, I had, in my mind, I had prayed for the first time in over a year. And the way I had prayed was that I had shook my fist at God and I had said, God, today is the day. I'm going to get drunk and I'm going to die. If you don't want that to happen, you better do something about it because I know what I'm going to do. I mean, is this arrogance? But that's what I did. In my anger and my fear and my confusion, I just shook my fist at God. And here he had the grace to send me Joe. And I kicked him out. And he left finally, and at 6 o'clock the babysitter came, and I went and kissed my children goodbye. Jessica was one at that time. I remember pulling her up on my lap and putting my arms around her and kissing her goodbye, and y'all, I didn't feel anything. I was just dead inside. And I was dead from the disease of alcoholism, and I hadn't had a drink in 9 months, but I was dead. And so I left, and I went to a motel, and I started drinking. And you know, the big book also says that when we pick up that first drink, it is no longer predictable what happens to us. Well, you know, my plan was to drink, and then I was going to take the pills, and I was just going to slide on out, and that was going to be the end of it, and it's over. Well, after I started drinking, I decided that there were a couple of things my parents needed to hear before I died. And I was in great form, and I was going to tell them. So I picked up the phone, and I called my parents, and to make a long story short, they live in South Carolina, and I'm there in Georgia, and they'd never heard me drunk before, bless their hearts, and they knew how desperate this situation was. But before I got off the phone with them, there were two women from Alcoholics Anonymous at my motel room door, and they came in, and to make a very long story short, I ended up back in the hospital again. And I ended up in a hospital down in South Georgia called Willingway. And when I got there, I was just emotionally, spiritually, and physically bankrupt. I just felt like I didn't have anything left to try with, that there wasn't anything inside me that was able to go on. And so for a long time after I got to Willingway, I just literally lay on my bed in my room. And they loved me enough to just wait, and they waited. And one day after I'd been there about 3 weeks or so, I decided I couldn't live like that any longer, and great manipulators that we can be, I stole a razor blade from them. Now, I had someone in my room 24 hours a day, but I was able to do that and maneuver some time alone, and I went to slit my wrists. And y'all, it was when I went to do that that I realized in just a very kind of quiet and defeated way that I didn't want to die from the disease of alcoholism. But what I wanted was to not live in the hell of it anymore. And I knew that if I wasn't going to live in the hell of alcoholism anymore, that I was going to have to come back to you and let you back in and drop my anger and let you love me. I also knew that I was going to have to let God back in. And that's kind of all I knew. And I knew I didn't want to die. And it was from that day that I began getting well. You know, I surrendered. And y'all know the feeling when, you know, there's been that war in your gut for months and years, and all of a sudden the war is over. The war was over. I had given up. Now, you know, I'd love to tell you that I just bounced back into recovery and lived happily ever after. But actually, I'm really glad to tell you it didn't happen that way. And it was a very slow, painful process. I suffered from the depression for a long time, and it was a long walk out of it. But you know, as I walked back out of it, I've never had to go back down deep into that hole again. I've not had to go back there, and I'm very grateful for that. I know that if I keep trudging, just like our big book says, and isn't it wonderful that it says trudging, because to me that just is neon letters of one day at a time. We take it one step at a time. And I don't have to be perfect at anything in my life except not picking up that first drink. That's the only thing I have to do perfectly. And otherwise that how it works tells me that, you know, it's progress, not perfection. Thank goodness. And I began the trudge back. And what support I have had. You know, as I came home from that hospital, one of my greatest fears was that I had used you up. I had been so bitter and, you know, and so pathetic and so angry for so long that I'd used you up. And we can use each other up. But I can't use up the group, that's for sure. And I came home and I found out, no, I had not used my group up. And I came home to a new sponsor. I'd asked another lady to help sponsor me also because Lillian was still so sick. And as I came home, this beautiful lady took me out to lunch that first day I was home. And she put a paperweight in the middle of the table as we were eating. And in this paperweight, there was a starfish. And she said, "Christy, I want you to take this home and put it in your kitchen where you can see it every day so you can remember what I'm going to tell you. She said, there was a man who was on vacation down at the beach, and he just loved the beach and loved to take long walks on the beach. And one day as he was walking along the beach, he noticed that thousands and thousands and thousands of starfish were getting washed up upon the shore and were drying out and they were dying. And so he began the very tedious task of bending down and picking up a starfish and throwing it back out into the ocean, picking up another one and throwing it back out into the ocean. And while he was doing that, this little boy came up to him and said, Mister, what are you doing? There are hundreds of thousands of starfish on this beach. You cannot save them all. Why even bother? And the man said as he bent down and picked up another starfish, because I think that this one's worth saving. And so's this one. And so's this one. You know, and that message stays with me today. You know, when I'm sponsoring people and I think, God, they're never going to get it, because God sends me so many people that are just like me, it's pathetic. You know, I think of my starfish. I think of my starfish, you know, we're all worth saving. And we keep trudging on. What a gift that I've been able to get sober, not once, but twice. So many of us go back out and don't make it back. You know, I don't know, except for the grace of God, that I was able to make it back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I still am afraid today. I have a great fear of that first drink. And I let that fear work as a very positive force in my life. I let it drive me to meetings, to my books, to my knees, to my sponsor, to my husband. You know, and I let it work to help keep me sober. Because unlike the first time I got sober, when I didn't even think about having a drink once I'd kind of surrendered and gotten into the program, there are times when I still have not lost that obsession and compulsion to drink. It is still with me. And for me, that's okay. I consider it a gift. You know, I know the disease of alcoholism is alive and well in Christy Miller, but I also know that if I take care of my spiritual condition one day at a time and stick close to you, I'm going to be okay. One last thing, and then I'm gonna end here. There are a lot of young people that have come into gyms in my life as I've recovered this second time. There are just a lot of people that have come into our lives that were not there before. And I think my drinking again has given me an ability to reach out like I didn't have before. And so I'm grateful for that. And it's all come full circle, and I'm no longer bitter about it. But there are a lot of young people who have come into our lives in our home, and we've had a really wonderful time with them. There were two young men in particular that were spending a lot of time at our house about 5 years ago or so. And it was the Christmas season. And when New Year's was coming up, we asked Chris and John if they would like to have a New Year's Eve party for the young people in the program at our house. And they said, yeah, that'd be a great idea. So on New Year's Eve, we took all the furniture out of our living room and rolled in speakers about as big as this podium, and that scared me a little. I told all my neighbors to leave home. We got some Coca-Cola and pretzels and whatnot. And after the meeting on New Year's Eve, all these young people came over to our house, and we just boogied in the New Year's. And, y'all, we just had a wonderful time. Well, about 1 o'clock in the morning, everyone was gone except for about 13 of us. And one of the kids said, let's have a meeting. Wouldn't that be a great way to start out the new year? And we said, yes, that's perfect. Let's have a meeting. So we sat there and we had a meeting. And y'all, as we were sitting there sharing about God and serenity, I looked around and I realized that we were on our porch in our rocking chair. And I thank you.